Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour autobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Wall Street veteran Bernie Madoff has been arrested and charged with running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. This is one of the biggest fraud cases ever.
We lost everything. We lost everything.
We are major crime victims. Bernie Madoff stole every dime we gave to him.
$1.3 million. That's all gone.
The retirement is never.
I guess his addiction was money.
Young Farrell Heathfield is that he got caught and he's behind bars.
Frank Casey was the first investment analyst to blow the whistle on rogue financier Bernie Madoff, who ran a $50 billion Ponzi scheme that looted the savings of thousands of people around the world. Casey is the managing partner of Peak Capital Strategies. He often testifies on behalf of Madoff victims in lawsuits filed against banks and financial institutions involved in dealings with Madoff. Frank, you've been asked this question 1,000 times. How did you discover that Bernie Madoff was a fraud?
I was with Rampart Investment Management. We were an equity options house, basically writing calls, allowing us to generate income on big pension monies. We ran $8 billion increase in the return for state pension funds. And I was also looking to engineer a new product. And so I went about it typically as an investment analyst would do it. How do you generate what everybody wanted, which was 1% a month with some degree of clockwork to it and not a lot of downside risk? And the way I went about it, because I knew the equity options markets, my field, I knew you couldn't generate 1% a month like clockwork.
Impossible.
Impossible. And so I went about it another way. I started speaking to big banks and saying, put together 25 or 30 of your smartest hedge fund managers in the world. Make sure that these guys don't do the same thing, that they even things out like an 8-cylinder car makes the engine run smoothly and a 1-cylinder or 2-cylinder would make it jerky as the devil. So you want a smooth ride. And so that ride being a nice steady state return. And then I took it to some international AAA rated banks and I said, here's this portfolio of 25 or 30 really sharp people around the world. Would you write me a guarantee that my clients will not lose money? And they said, well, yes, what we'll do is if you, as long as you don't lose 10%, so a year. So I went in and tried to offer this to big pension funds, insurance companies, and wealthy investors around the world. Harry Markopoulos, my portfolio manager at the time when I was at Rampart designing these products, says to me, I have a friend who works for a money manager downtown, and that manager found a single smart guy, not 25 or 30 smart guys, doing something in the equity options market, and he's producing 1% a month like clockwork. Well, we were an options house, like I said, running $8 billion. And so, and I was exercising options and trading in them since 1974 when I got out of the Army. So I knew what options don't do, but I had to go see this manager.
In New York.
In New York. And this manager would not tell me who he was invested in, who his secret manager was, because the game was that if you told who your manager was, that manager would fire you, and that manager being Bernie Madoff, of course, unknown to me at the time. So I said to Thierry Megon de la Villiche, I said on Madison Avenue, I said, Thierry, I hear you have this manager producing 1% a month. He says, I do. And I said, who is it? He says, I cannot tell you. Because he'll give me my money back, and I don't want my money back. And I said, well, okay.
This guy was French royalty, wasn't he?
He was French royalty. And Thierry Megon de la Villiche, if I'm not mistaken, was the past president of Credit Lyonnais USA, the big French bank. And so he had dealt with the uber-wealthy bankers around the world, the private bankers in Switzerland and Geneva, you know, and so forth, Zurich, and into through France. He was a de la Villiche, and I don't know much about French history, but the Deleuzes were all decapitated, most of them. But he lived in Brittany, and so he survived. And after the facts, a researcher told me many several years later the De La Villiers bailed out Louis XIV. So these guys had some money.
And what did he say to you?
He said, well, the man executes an option strategy. I said, really? I said, what's the strategy? He says, split strike conversion.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, I was doing that in 75 through 78, and I know what it doesn't do. It doesn't produce 1% a month like clockwork. It's path dependent, as we say in our industry. In other words, if the market goes up, you'll make money. If the market goes down, you'll lose money. So I knew it right away. It didn't make any sense.
Eventually, you got him to tell you that it was Bernie Madoff.
He never told me. What he showed me were confirmations with a magic marker blacking out the name of the firm, the secret manager. And he was trying to get me to basically validate everything he was doing. And I said, a manager who's – these trades are done to you without any commissions. They're traded net. That means this guy is a market maker. So I figured out that he was a dealer on the streets of Wall Street, okay?
The guy is – Bernie
the secret,
Madoff. Madoff. The
yeah.
secret guy is Bernie Madoff.
Exactly. And so when Thierry Meghan de Villiers turned his head, I spun one of these confirms on a clerk's desk and saw Bernard Madoff Securities because I was just too curious. And so I didn't even know who the guy was. And the reason was is because I have been in derivatives and I've been trading options on equities, but then I moved into futures contracts, balancing corporate price risk on raw materials. I got into bank risk management, hedging bank risk on interest rates, using options on these futures, on the financial instruments like U.S. Treasury, government bonds, against mortgage origination, which means when you and I get mortgages out at a bank, they would mask these mortgages and sell them off as an investment instrument. And I was hedging all of these risks for these banks. So I'm very astute in the world of derivatives, as they call it, okay? But I didn't actually ever trade big blocks of stock. So this guy Madoff was a block trader, as they say on the street. When a Fidelity or a Putnam or any large firm needed to move a massive position of a stock, say IBM, you don't dump it on the market and just say sell it because it'll depress the price.
You just didn't look at him and say, I know this is the bad guy. What was it that triggered your interest in his nefarious
plans? Well, supposedly, I asked Thierry Meghan de Villiers, I said, hey, how much does this secret manager charge you for all this intellectual property of delivering 1% a month? He says, he charges me nothing. And I said, what? I said, Thierry, if I could design something for you that produced 1% a month like clockwork, I'd be charging 2% per year plus one-fifth of the profits. And he said, I said, well, if he's not getting fees, who's getting the fees? He says, I am. And I said, why would he be happy with you getting fees? He says, well, he does his business ancillary to his main trading business, and he just does it on the side, and he's just happy with the commissions, which made absolutely no sense at all because if you know how block trading and so forth, they might make a nickel, maybe on a hot day, 15 cents a share. And Thierry's making 15 times as much money annualized. So why would this guy give all his intellectual property, his intelligence, his super secret trading system to Thierry to allow him to make 15 times the money? It made no sense at all.
And someday, after a while, he committed suicide because he brought so many people into the Bernie sphere of influence.
Yeah, he became a friend of Harry Markopoulos and I. And we attempted a joint venture in another area of the business, totally different with Thierry, because he had access to something I didn't have. The Queen wasn't inviting me to tea. And he was connected to all the royalty of Europe through these private wealth management banks. And I had an asset management shop, and I'm saying, we're great fabricators of product. If I can fabricate the product, he can be my distributor through Europe. And so I was trying to befriend him and work with him and build other products. We warned him from 1999 until last time I warned him was over dinner in 2002, I believe, where I said, just he and I. And I said, Thierry, you told me the day that I met you that you had $320 million with this guy. That's a massive amount of money. And what if Harry and I are correct and this guy is a Ponzi scheme, a fraud? A Ponzi is rob Peter to pay Paul. And so basically you take new money from guys investing and you pay off old investors so they think they're getting a return when actually you're just shuttling cash across the ledger. And so he says to me, there, he puts down his drink. He looks me right in the eye with all seriousness. And he says, Frank, if you are wrong, and you can't be right, I mean, you can't be correct. But if you are correct and I am wrong, I am a dead man.
And he became a dead man. He killed
When somebody says that to you, you laugh nervously because you don't know how serious they are. And I said, Thoree, you don't, what do you mean by that? He says, let me put it this way. I have all of my money in it. I have most of my family's money in it. I have every banker in private wealth management around the world that I've cultivated my whole career in it, and I probably have half the royalty of Europe in it. I have no out.
You know, those sound bites that we recorded at the beginning of the show were anguish cries of Americans who lost their money. Very little has been known about the enormous losses of people around the globe, and the documentary that was produced 5 years ago called Chasing Manoff, a wonderful hour and 20 minutes, it's all about Europe, isn't it, and Asia and all this.
Yeah, it has victims. It's only victims and the team that hunted and chased Madoff, Harry Markopoulos, myself, Harry's assistant, portfolio manager Neil Cello, an investigative reporter. This will warm your heart. I recruited Michael Okron, an investigative reporter. No one would touch this story because we did not have a smoking gun. We had a mosaic of intelligence, just like as an intelligence officer in the military. You get snippets and you put together a picture. And that's what we were doing. Don't forget, this guy was an octopus hiding in a rock. And all of his tentacles were these funds that were out scouring victims and bringing them in to feed the octopus.
But he
was all quiet.
He had some resume. I mean, former chairman of NASDAQ, Bernie.
You know, when I first brought this strategy back in the spring of 99 to Harry Markopoulos, first I spoke to the bosses at Rampart who owned the company, and they said, oh, this is phenomenal. We'll compete. And because Thoree said to me, if you can compete, I will give you part of my $320 million. And so I wanted to develop a strategy to get him to distribute. So the bottom line was that we asked Harry to reverse engineer mathematically. What's this guy doing? Because I knew it wasn't options. He said it was options, but we know we were an options house, and we knew that would be phony.
And you knew that he couldn't be producing the amount of returns that he was producing.
Not with the strategy that he said. So we figured that was a straw man, that was put up as the explanation, and he was really doing something seriously different. I told Thoree the first time I met him in the spring of 99, I said, listen, it's not like you have an account at Charles Schwab and you've hired this investment manager, third party, with a limited power of attorney to trade your account, but your assets are secure at Charles Schwab. You're basically providing money right to this secret manager and you're investing side by side with his own capital and he's probably treating you as dumb equity. And he says, what do you mean I'm not dumb? I said, not you're dumb. I said, he might be making 1,000% on your money a year and paying you 16%.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Our guest is Frank Casey, managing partner of Peak Capital Strategies and the first security analyst to unearth the bogus investment schemes of Bernie Madoff, which is often called the worst Ponzi schemes ever in the financial world. Let's talk about you as a person, not just as a crazed investigator trying to find out all about him, right?
Okay.
Tell me about the life of Frank Casey. You didn't start out wanting to be a whistleblower, did you?
Oh, no. I mean, basically, I still don't want to be a whistleblower. I was going to be a career military officer. I mean, I left home at 19, was married before 20 years of age, had a baby before I was 20, worked in a steel mill 48 hours a week, and killed rats for a living on the side, and went to school full time and lived in the back of a Volkswagen.
In Massachusetts?
In Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, Penn Stater.
And so I was down at Abington campus, down by Jenkintown, Ardsley, Willow Grove. And so my father was moved us out of the slums of Philly into like a Levitt town would be, all track housing. You know, he was a pharmacist. But in either case, I've got a strong core of what's right and wrong, an ethos, and I have a work ethic. And here I am, 67, and I'll work until I drop because I just love the challenge and the competition intellectually every day.
You were a teenage groom. You married your school sweetheart, tell me. Then you had a son before you were 20. You got divorced at 31. Then you remarried.
Oh, you did some research, yeah.
No, I got it from you. You better be telling me the truth. You remarried at 36 to Judy, a single mother of Sarah. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about Sarah.
Sarah is a very unique person. When she was born, her biological father bolted. She is a little person, sometimes called a dwarf. There are many different flavors of dwarfism, I have come to learn. And she is in a chondroplastic, which means a normal trunk, you know, from the hips to the throat, top of the throat, but short limbs. And so anyhow, she – well, it was funny. When I met Judy, we went on a couple dates. I fell in love with her the first night. And so she said on the second or third date, you know, I'm a single mom. I said, I don't really like kids. And I had already raised my kids. She says, well, my kid's special. And I said, yeah, every mother thinks a kid's special. But she meant special. Sarah has even changed my life. When she hit 13 years of age, she researched herself. Not that she has anything about being short. There's nothing wrong with that. We would go to little people's conventions every year to just – learn how to deal with life, okay? And so she said, I'm going to stretch myself 25 to 27% of my body height. And it's going to take me 4 years. And it's an operation that was developed in Madrid. And Cedars-Sinai, Spielberg gifted the wing of the Genetic Center in L.A., Beverly Hills. We qualified for this thing. There was no insurance in those days, experimental. She was number six to be operated in the United States. The first four were out of Latin America. We went through this four-year project. She took herself from 310 to 410. And she's an amazing woman. She works for a private equity house as a manager of or a personal assistant, if you would say, to the top bosses there.
And you have a military background, don't you?
Yeah, military
because
background.
Penn State, you joined ROTC during a period when a lot of people did not want to see ROTC on campuses, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was tough because when you're young, you want peer acceptance, right? And here I am walking around in military greens and camouflage outfits and training. I not only was a senior cadet in the ROTC.
What year was that?
That was 66 to 70 when I graduated from Penn State, but in 66, I also challenged myself to become a Ranger, which was an ROTC affiliate trained by Special Forces right on campus. And they were training us to be great leaders, basically. Yeah, we learned military tactics, but it was a leadership school. And so I became their elected leader in 67. And I still get together with these guys in the mountains of Pennsylvania once a year and to drink beer and tell lies, you know, and in a rustic cabin. I love them. They were my fraternity. And so here I was working 48 to 54 hours a week, going to school full time, senior cadet at the
ROTC. Married at the time as well.
Married and then running the Ranger unit. And I would train every Thursday night with the Rangers. And every month we would fight a military school out in Fort Dix, New Jersey or some god-awful place like Indian Town Gap, Pennsylvania in the wintertime.
Yeah. And you developed what you told me was a foxhole theory?
Foxhole theory. Yeah, I still run by it. In other words, what is that? It's my feeling, the way I judge people. And every time I have violated it, it's cost me time and money and friendship. My theory is this. If I can't trust you in business like I would trust my foxhole partner to guard my life while I'm sleeping, then I really don't want to do business with you. And every time I have reached beyond those parameters of absolute trust, willingness to trust, I've usually burnt myself, usually driven by greed.
Give me an idea of you burning yourself.
Well, burning yourself, you go into a deal with a business person, right? It's a handshake. Now, your ethos might be in that handshake that you deliver until you die. And other people's ethos might be contract isn't worth anything. It's just another stage in negotiation.
So some people have a shake, can shake their hand, and the other person, no matter what is written, won't matter anyway.
It won't matter anything. A team of lawyers won't bail you out.
And it's worked?
Yeah.
Most of the time?
It keeps me straight most of the time.
Well, the group that you guys were involved in, you and Harry and Chris, all these guys, you were sort of a foxhole group, right?
We were. Harry's ex-military. I'm ex-military. And, you know, not to wrap ourselves in the flag. Honest to God, this was done for duty, honor, and country because – we knew it to be wrong. It was our duty to report it. Our chain of command was to the Securities Exchange Commission, the regulators. The FBI asked us, why didn't you bring it to us? I said, come on, in all fairness, you guys wouldn't have understood it. You would have gone to the SEC to validate it. They would have told you it's worth nothing. as the SEC said to everybody, that – I mean, we had testimonies that we put together, a 26-page paper that Harry authored, really, with 30 red flags. And I'm telling you, these were not innuendos. These were case studies and these red flags. You give an English graduate from a university these 30 red flags and you say, pick three randomly, go in to talk to Madoff, and you would have caught the fraud.
And your friend Harry said it only took him 5 minutes to figure out the whole thing was a fraud.
That's right, because when I brought him back, Rene's track record with this guy, secret manager, Harry said, come on, you're an options guy, Frank. You know this is a fraud at the least, and it's probably a Ponzi scheme, paying Paul by robbing Peter. And I said, yeah, I know. I mean, it's not what he's doing. He's got to be doing something else. Don't say the word Ponzi. This guy is the chairman of the NASDAQ, which was the over-the-counter stock trading. This guy was trading 5 to 7% of the total volume of all stocks traded daily in the United States. This guy was a monster. You don't call that kind of a guy a Ponzi scheme until you get more information. So Harry said, well, go dig up more information. I want to take it to the SEC. And so began the quest. We shook hands, spring of 99, and I got more intelligence. We start to put together an intelligence network around the world.
And you're still doing it?
Well,
sort of.
I testify for victims. I only work for victims. I don't work for big banks that were somehow a victim and because of their own self-delusion. I work for investors. And I help their legal teams figure out what to do with all the data dump that they get in discovery. I mean, one lawyer, just the name of the document and a one-line statement as to what was in the document they think was 525 pages long, the index. So where do they go? So they hire a guy like me who can move through this stuff quickly. I know how banks work. I know how derivatives markets work. And then I start telling them, audit all of the email trails out of this guy, and this guy. I want to hear the audio tapes of the risk committee meetings of these, you know, around the world.
The documentary Chasing Madoff, which was produced in 2010, and thousands of people were hurt by that. And at that time, I think it was 12 or 13 people were convicted. But nothing seems to have happened, really.
You know, this really bothers me. Some big offenders got off with a wrist slap of a major fine, but no one went to jail. And that bothers me. Who what?
Who was slapped in the wrist?
Oh, wow. I mean, everybody from the regulators themselves got to retire or say they're going to pursue other interests instead of being fired. All the way down through major banks that were custodying the money that Madoff was supposedly running, verifying the assets were there when they were never there because they took the word of Bernie Madoff as the sub-custodian. I mean, the whole thing is so ludicrous. So, you know, I'm out there helping people get their money back through legal action.
Our guest on this edition of Conversation with Alan Wolper is Frank Casey, the first investment analyst to blow the whistle on Bernie Madoff's incredible Wall Street scheme. What did the Securities and Exchange Commission do after it was informed about Madoff's scam? Nothing. That reaction infuriated Congress. Here is what former Congressman Gary Ackerman told SEC officials what he thought of their behavior at a congressional hearing.
What the heck went on? Your mission, you said, was to protect investors and detect fraud quickly. How'd that work out? What went wrong? One guy with a few friends and helpers discovered this thing nearly a decade ago, led you to this pile of dung that is Bernie Madoff and stuck your nose in it, and you couldn't figure it out. You have single-handedly diffused the American public of any sense of confidence in our financial markets if you are the watchdogs. You have totally and thoroughly failed in your mission. Don't you get it?
What kept the SEC from trying to find out what happened? I mean, you guys were crazy. And I know that your colleague Harry was carrying around a weapon because he was afraid that somehow he was going to be attacked.
Harry descended into paranoia, and he was very frank about that representation. He didn't try to hide it in our Chasing Madoff video documentary. Harry traveled with Thierry Meghan de la Villiche to Europe and saw 20 banks. And the reason that Thierry took Harry was eventually after I had left Rampart, Harry claimed that he had a system that would compete with Madoff. Well, I mean, I looked at the system and I laughed and I said to Harry, you know, if you wake up on the wrong side of bed on the last day of trading of these markets, why, your clients could lose 25, 30%. And he goes, oh, no, 50%. I said, who would buy this? He says, well, Thierry wants to show it to these big French banks because I compete with Madoff on the return stream, but I'm a little riskier. I said, I wouldn't touch this with a barge pole. But anyhow, Thierry took him to see 20 banks. In those meetings, 14 of those banks said the same exact thing. Out of Geneva, Switzerland, Paris, wherever. You know, this is pretty good. It's a competitive strategy to Madoff. A little higher return, but more risk. You know, we have Bernie Madoff. Madoff never loses any money. There's no risk to Bernie Madoff. And we had XY, you know, he's closed. He's not accepting any new money. By the way, we heard that from the time we began the investigation in 09 all the way, I mean, in 1999 all the way to 2008. He's closed, you know. He's not accepting any new money, but he takes our money and our money only at XYZ in Geneva.
It's amazing. It seems 14 like he was of them. Facilitators, right? He managed to separate himself on degrees of separation.
Well, you know, if you're the private banker to Philippe Umpty-Ump, you know, Lord of such and such, and Philippe goes grouse shooting with Jonathan, his prince partner, friend, and Jonathan says, I'm getting 1% a month like clockwork. You go back to your banker in Geneva and you say, I want that manager. And they say, well, this guy looks a little shaky. We don't want to do it. He says, well, you get me that manager. I'm moving over to Jonathan's banker.
Why didn't America's bank regulators, seeing these hundreds of millions of dollars going through the bank, why didn't they do anything?
Well, that's a big question. You know, some cases have been fines have been settled on what we call a lack of filing SARs or suspicious activity reports. And when you have a lot of churning of money and a movement of money between accounts in various countries, it's usually people laundering money to hide mob money or terrorists. Now, those guys should have reported that stuff. And in some cases, it was Madoff's own operations moving money around the world quietly.
Well, I'm a little confused. I know Elliot Spitzer was caught because of a $3,000 transaction, but you couldn't find things like J.P. Morgan getting something like $400 million in fees for what was going on with Madoff.
And you
explain
know
that to me.
Well, there's no explanation. I mean,
come
let's
on,
face
you
it,
have
the
to have an
no.
Come on, Frank. Tell those people out there how this happens.
Well, I would say that I don't know much about Elliot, but I would say it was probably more politically motivated than pure financial motivation.
Frank Casey, Peak Capital Strategies. The first investment analyst to uncover the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme that cost so many people their life savings. Joanna Wolper is senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer. If you want to hear any of our autobiographies, our 100 autobiographies, Google Conversations with Alan Wolper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.